Emptiness. I want to speak a bit about emptiness. So emptiness means when not able to exist from its own side. Okay, so not able to exist from its own side. We don't have that up there. Inherent existence is in the translation chat there. So we could say it doesn't have inherent existence. Yeah, it's not able to exist from its own side. So we started off with this concept right at the beginning. Yeah, we talked about emptiness right from the beginning. That when there's an experience, there's an object and an atmosphere. Right. And what I think we've been seeing through the retreat so far is that when we change that atmosphere, the object changes. Yeah. So the object is not independent of the atmosphere. Yeah. So it might be more helpful, it's certainly more helpful in English, as far as I can tell, it's to not think too much about this word emptiness, even though we put it in the title of the retreat. Yeah, that was just to get you here. No, I'm only kidding. It's more helpful to think of things being empty, okay? So rather than emptiness sounds like a place you could go, you know, that I'm sitting in emptiness. Or that things come into and out of emptiness. And all of those phrases are used in spiritual circles, and I don't mean to belittle them. I'm not putting like a special voice on and saying things like as if they're really stupid to think that way. I actually think those conceptions of emptiness have a place, yeah, and have a usefulness on the path. But I think in terms of being applicable for freedom, it's actually more helpful for me to think of things being empty. I think in general the usefulness of words is in their verbs, not in their nouns. Yeah, the nouns tend to give us this more feeling of things being fixed. You know, we actually misperceive they might be full of something. But just as we looked in that meditation before, as we did the elements, actually space is the majority of what things are. And then it's just small little bits of matter in the things. And nouns are the same way. Yeah? Nouns are these vehicles. Words are vehicles. They carry these meanings. But sometimes we fill them out as if they're full of this meaning. But they're actually shaped by the verbs that move with them. Yeah. So if something's not always the same way, yeah, it's not always the same way, it's dependent on the atmosphere, then we have to say it's empty, empty of inherent existence. So for example, when we bring a metta atmosphere via words or intentions or just this kind of vibration of energy to a phenomena, including a person, any phenomena, any thing, yeah, it shapes how they appear to us, how they feel to us, and even whether they appear at all. Okay, we'll come on to this. Because every phenomena, and we're using phenomena, it comes from the Greek meaning appearance. Right? It means an appearance. So every phenomena, it's a bit lighter word than thing, yeah? It's a phenomena, it's an appearance, everything we contact, all the sense doors, what the Buddha called the all of the all. Yeah, everything that we as human beings can tune into, the whole frequency, the whole sensitivity, whatever we can think or even conceive of, is empty. It's empty. Because they depend on the atmosphere. And it might seem so obvious, we could just put it out there at the beginning of the retreat, and it might feel like, oh, that's really obvious, you know, that's not really special. But if we really think, like, what is the power of this in meditation as a meditative tool? If it means, it actually means something incredibly subtle. It actually means that things neither exist independent, as we might automatically presume, Yeah. Yet it doesn't mean they don't exist either. And that's such a refined, sensitive way of looking at something, right? It neither exists nor does not exist. The mind loves certainty, and it almost doesn't know what to do with this principle of the reality of things, we could say, yeah? The way that things come into appearance. It is arising, but dependent on the atmosphere at that time. Dependently arising only because of the flavor of attention that's holding it in attention. Change that, and the phenomena changes or fades away. Yeah? Amazing. If something's dependent on the atmosphere, it is empty. And that does not mean it does not exist, nor have meaningfulness to us, for us. Yeah? It just means that it's empty of inherently existing. And as we explore today, we add a sense of reality to the owner of experience as well in the way that we look. And we can soften that as we did today. And if there weren't for these teachings, I wonder if I would actually question the true existence of the owner of experience, yeah, or the identified one who's having the experience. But we understand in terms of what fabricates dukkha, what fabricates difficulty, it's really skillful to bring that into attention. So again, it's a very fine thing to deal with when we're dealing with the sense of self, with the appearance of self. We might wish to say either the self is real and it exists, or we might want to say the self is not real and it does not exist. But all of these teachings that the Buddha was guiding us towards are very, very subtle, very, very difficult locations to retain steadiness with. Yeah? The self neither exists nor does not exist. And what are we going to do? What are we going to do with that? How do we hold something like that? That is so light, so refined, so beautiful. This sense of self neither exists nor does not exist. That is what the emptiness teachings are suggesting. Now, whenever there's an object in attention, there's going to be a sense of self that appears there holding that object in attention. Yeah? Co-arising together, objects and self. Yeah? That's the felt experience of reality. So this is another way that we could say it. So using that Greek word and expanding it is phenomenological, right? So the logic, the logos, the idea of exploring phenomena. We see how is our experience coming into being? How is it actually happening? And we stay steady with that, and we have to admit the Buddha was right. It neither exists nor does not exist independently of itself, independently of the object. The sense of self changes dependent on the object and the atmosphere. And just because of that, we have to say the sense of self is empty. Yeah, the sense of self is empty. If there's a lot of dukkha and craving, we get strong objects. Yeah, objects become really solid, really vivid. And also a fixed feeling of self, of I am, that engagement into the moment. And if there's less craving, there's less fabrication, there's less making, there's less I making and me making, and there's less object making. So the way of looking, shaped by tanha, by craving, by demanding, makes that object stronger. When it's less, the object becomes less and the sense of self becomes less. And with no object, of course, there's also no sense of self. Yeah? So no craving, no object, no sense of self. Everything calms down. Then they all rise up again together. And then they all rise down again together. Yeah? The lighter the object and atmosphere, the lighter the sense of self. So if the sense of self changes, it's already worthy of being called empty. And furthermore, it can't be who you or I we normally sense it to be. Yeah, we don't sense it to be something that's changing according to objects and atmospheres. We have a sense, I've been me through this whole life, and there's like a continuity, there's a sense that, you know, I've gone through all the time. I didn't pop into and out of being according to the objects and atmospheres that were going on. Yeah, I had a continuity. Sure, you know, the body's changed, the thoughts have changed, my preferences have changed, but it's always been me. Yeah, it's always been me. It's undeniably me. But we're just this stitched together, changing form that we have an illusion that we sense, there's continuity here, which when we investigate, it seems to fall apart. We feel like we're here listening to this talk, you know, and we started this retreat together. All of these things we feel, we just intuit that they're true. Yeah, and we can change and the sense of self will adjust to it. Yeah. But where are you? Where do you exist? When you really look for it, we're presumed to exist. Maybe we're in the head somewhere and we look for it. Well, I can't find it. Can't find it. Maybe we're some aspect of consciousness. Yeah. None of this really makes sense. We're presumed to exist, but impossible to find. Presumed to exist, but impossible to find. So, bringing this back to the qualities of metta, you know, these are insights that are only accessible, only really enjoyable, maybe, once there's a lot of metta, once there's a lot of kindness. Yeah, we can take non-existence, yeah, the possibility of non-existence, so that we can play with that location of neither existing nor really existing. Which kind of reminds me of when you're trying to do a handstand. You've got to be willing to fall all the way over before you can really get to that point of balance. Yeah, if you're always like, I don't want to fall over, you keep going too short and you come back down again. It's that willingness with all that metta. It's like, yeah, I could flop over and wind myself by hitting myself on the back, you know, and lose all the ability to breathe for 30 seconds or so. It's like, it's worth it. I could get to really good balance, and it takes that kind of courage. And so the metta practice, the samadhi practice, gets us into a good place where we can do that. And one of the ways I think it's helpful possibly to talk about as a almost like an interlude in this talk is to come back to what happens in our minds, what happens in our thinking minds as we practice together. Now, something interesting happens in terms of the identification with thoughts. Yeah, it's one of the things we probably get the most identified with as a kind of modern humans. Yeah, get identified in the realm of thoughts. And I just want to share a couple of things that the Buddha said about thoughts that I think are just so precious to have on our radar. So there's a wonderful sutta to read at some point for you called The Two Sorts of Thinking. Precious instructions in here, and also beautiful images of kind of discovering the path of practice and what it can do for us. It's a very, very nourishing read. Really recommend it. There's a few key phrases in it that I think are just you should really try and remember. Yeah. So when the Buddha speaks about thoughts, he says the thought occurred to me. He never says, I thought, or I am thinking, or this is what I think. Yeah, it's the thought occurred to me. And that, I think, at least this is how it's translated, yeah? So obviously the Buddha didn't speak English or Hebrew, but the thought occurred to me. Has that sense of like there are thoughts that fly through something, and then some of them get tangled up in the hairs of our sensitivity, and they occur to us. Yeah? We don't generate them. They're not ours. And that sense of non-identification is really, really helpful to have towards thoughts. We will often identify with thoughts, and identification with thoughts makes them much less easy to work with, much less easy. So that's the first move in terms of thoughts. Yeah, it was also the N in rain when we're working with the hindrances, which is no surprise because a lot of our hindrances come through thoughts. Okay, comes through thought activity. The second step after the non-identification, the lighter non-identification, this is a thought occurring to me. There is a thought occurring to me, is to evaluate them. And that's why the sutta is called the two sorts of thinking. And so basically the Buddha suggests a practice that we have, which is a little bit like a we could imagine having kind of two trays in front of us, and a thought occurs to us, and it either belongs in one tray or it belongs in the other tray. And we could say that one tray is metta and the other tray is dukkha. Yeah, we could say that. He didn't exactly say that, but we could say that. What he said was one tray is these kind of hindrance qualities of greed, of ill will, and he also added harmfulness. So not just ill will, not just the rejection, but actually the willingness to have a thought that's going to cause harm to someone. Yeah? Pretty active, nasty type of thought that human beings are capable of having. Yeah, but we do. But they're thoughts that occur to us. They're not ours. They don't mean you're a bad person for having a bad thought. Yeah. And the good meditating sense is that we work on our actions. Okay. And we work to support environments in which those kinds of thoughts are less likely to occur to us. But if they do occur to us, we're also really clear, it's about our skillfulness in actions. It's our skillfulness in actions. And thoughts, you know, they're not us. They come and go. So we could have this box of thoughts, greed, ill will, hatred. Does that all make sense?
Yeah.
And the other box is the opposites. So non-greed, non-ill will, non-harmfulness. Or in other words, renunciation. I'm sure you are all just waiting for that word renunciation. You love it. It's your favourite word. And then we can say non-ill will, kindness, metta. Yeah. And non-harmfulness, compassion. Compassionate, coming to the aid of those who are not doing so well. But he did actually literally say them in the negative. And for good reasons, which we won't go into for now, but it actually opens the range, we could say. But we won't go into that at this point. It's not so relevant. And I want to be more precise tonight. Now, when we look at it, all of the activities in this pot, the non-metta pot, they actually cause anxiety for us. They cause distress for us. And they cause friction in our relationships with others. The greed, the ill will, the harmfulness. And they cause distrust. Yeah, distrust, disharmony, anxiety and friction. They're no good for us, they're no good for other people. Right? They don't lead to happiness, they don't lead to well-being. And if we do our activities with a meditator's sensitivity, which is to say we eat what we cook, yeah, we actually sit there and we taste it and we chew it, and we feel what it's like, then we realize, actually, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. And the way the Buddha describes it, he says, and it is wiped out of existence. That thought is wiped out of existence. And it's such a dramatic language. But we have to understand that it's wiped out of existence because it's not fabricated. It's not fabricated because without the support of it, if we don't support it, it can't exist. It's empty of existing on its own. It needs the atmosphere to support it. If we incline into metta, yeah, life changes because it's dependently arising. And it's a renunciation for a higher goal. And I think that this is the key way to understand renunciation. We renounce it because we actually want to do something that's going to support lasting happiness. Not kind of momentary sensations, but lasting happiness, lasting well-being through metta, through compassion, and through renunciation, through letting go of patterns of behavior which are no longer appropriate for us. You know, like when we do exercise, or when we eat a compassionate diet, or we give up smoking, you know, or something like this. It's like we're giving them up for something better, giving them up for something kinder, something more beautiful. And of course, they're not ours, they're not our thoughts, they occurred to us. Pick them up or don't. Yeah? It's a very skillful way of working with thoughts, and it's less problematic. And when something's less problematic, we're also less likely to identify with it. And we can hold those processes and get lighter around the realm of thoughts. Thoughts and feelings. So what we're saying is, there's wisdom in the way that we can relate to thoughts. There's wisdom in the way that we can relate to the appearance of self. There's wisdom in the way that we can relate to the appearance of anything. And experience is shaped by wisdom and understanding. It's so important to support wisdom and understanding. Any insights that you've gathered in your life, yeah, they're not for your bookshelf. Yeah, they're for your life. They're to change the way you live. Because wisdom fabricates a different outcome than ignorance or misunderstanding. Yeah. Wisdom fabricates a different experience, a different life, a different perspective, different sense of what this is than ignorance or misunderstanding. And of course, it's going to take time. We're really shifting radical senses of what reality is. So what do we tend to misunderstand? Yeah, simple things. This is the three characteristics of misunderstanding that the Buddha laid out for us. Yeah, the three characteristics. The misunderstanding that things don't last. Things don't last. Anicca. Things don't last. Stop acting like they last. Yeah, it's not doing you or anyone else any good, this misunderstanding. So just don't, try not to think that way. Yeah, just remind yourself. Could be good to get a tattoo, maybe, on your face. Things don't last. See if it can last a lifetime with you. Yeah, make a good joke, actually. The second really important thing that we misunderstand, that stress, dukkha, is in the way of relating. Dukkha is in the way we're relating to life. It's not in things. It's not in people, however annoying they are. Yeah, the dukkha is in the way of relating. And the third thing is that things don't exist from their own side. Things are empty, including this whole sense of self, any sense of object, all the way the world is appearing to you right now. It seems like it really exists from its own side, but it's fabricated by the atmosphere of your attention. Yeah? What you experience as the world is quite individual. Quite individual. It doesn't exist from its own side. And then when we look with an insightful lens, we see a different world. So when we look with anicca, this won't last. This won't last. We can feel the greed, the hatred softens. Just feel it soften. This won't last. This thing I'm craving after, or this thing I'm really feeling a problem about. We see it with a bit more insight, and the object softens. Yeah, the object softens. The object, what we're correctly calling a phenomena, the Greek for appearance, it starts to disappear. It fades. Everything that appears to us is an appearance. It is a perception. Yeah? It is a perception. We call it things, reality. We presume it exists independently from the way of looking, but it doesn't. Now, I wanted to do that elements meditation earlier, and I did the elements meditation in my own particular way. I don't know if it would be authorized by the Buddha to play around with it in that way. Because I wanted us to see, when we look for solidity, when we look for earth, did your body get heavier? Right? It might just be me that this happens to, but when I look for the solidity, I actually feel I feel the body almost unable to hold its weight. It gets so much heavier. When I feel it as fluid, as watery, I feel that it's much more fluid, it's much more loose, and it's just kind of floppy and things like this. Could just be me, yeah. So anyway, so I'm describing my experience. Or it gets lighter, or even really incredibly spacious when we see it as fire and air and space. Yeah? It changes according to the way we look at it. And how could that be? How could that actually be? So maybe it is just me, yeah? But what I would say then, at least in my experience, the insight for me is that I imagine my body. Yeah, I actually imagine the body. What I feel of the body is dependent on what I look at the body to see there, and I can play with that and create a sense of the body through the way I look at it, through the way I anticipate what I'm going to find, and I tune into that, and if I keep tuning in on that level, I can increase that particular fabrication, that particular perception of body. And actually, I know it's not just me, because there's a whole path of practice called the jhanas, yeah, and they're all based on playing with the perception of what the body is. Yeah. So in the jhanas, we can see the body as different things. We can see the body as being made up of delightful energy, delightful rippling energy. And it's possible to perceive that in the body. And it's a deeply nourishing way of perceiving body. And it's a deeply nourishing perception of seeing the body. Yeah? Or we could see the body as being made up of happiness. Actually see the body that way. And you can understand, well, that would be a very nice state to be in. You know, we can see the body made up of peacefulness or vast spaciousness. And if we can see our body in such different ways, you know, because the perception is the key, the intention of attention is key. Like, what else can we do? If we could change the way a physical thing like the body appears to us, maybe we can change our minds. Yeah, maybe we can change our world. We can see the world in ways which engender a confidence, a courage, a capacity, a nourishment, so that we can actually change the physical reality that we share with other beings. We can share possibilities of changing from greedy, individualistic beings to caring, loving, considerate beings that care about all the living beings on this planet. You know, just as much as we do at the end of a metta meditation, that we can shape the way reality appears. In the delightful Metta Sutta, yeah, which is, you know, worth a bedtime read on a daily basis. Yeah, such a delight, such a sweet story. And maybe we just have a moment just to say the origin story of it is that the monks went off to practice in this beautiful forest that actually was inhabited by spirits. And the spirits were like, hey, monks, I don't think, you know, we want you in here. So they made bad smells and, you know, caused them to feel anxiety. And the monks ran away, monks, maybe nuns as well, ran away, came back to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, you know what you need to do is get out there and you need to do this metta practice. Metta what? Metta practice. All right, well, how's it go? And then he just goes out and he tells them how to do this stuff. And it's just a really fun, beautiful thing. But it's also like the two sorts of thinking, yeah? Is that you have to understand what's going on in your mind. And you have to cultivate the capacity not to identify with all this experience that's happening and grow the capacities of the heart, grow the capacities of the mind so that we can bring more and more beauty, incline to the metta qualities which are already inherent in you. Yeah? It's not like you don't have good thoughts. Yeah? It's not like you don't have thoughts of renunciation, of kindness, of compassion. But they don't necessarily go to everyone, go everywhere. You know, and there's this beautiful image in there that speaks of the image of devoted, sustained love. Devoted and sustained love. How a mother would care for her child, her only child. That focus, that dedication in that image. Can we start to work towards that, work on that muscle that's got that capacity for us? You know, and they say, so too should the practitioner cultivate that kind of spacious focus, that kind of gentle dedication, that devoted and sustained love. Should develop that so that we feel it towards all beings. Yeah. So that all beings feel well-being, feel that there's someone, somewhere in the world who's practicing for you. Yeah. So that they can feel that, perhaps some way, when they're feeling really sensitive, feeling really alone, that there is someone practicing metta at this moment for us as we sit together and talk. There's someone who's practicing for all beings right now. And so we could say there are two threads to metta practice. Drenching the body, heart, mind, in well-being. Yeah, like in these jhanas, like just really saturating, spreading through a feeling of metta, feeling of well-being. And we've been doing that in the meditations, yeah? Welcoming everything. Everything is welcome. Any sensation, any thought, any sound, just saturating that. So that's one way of practicing metta. And another way is expanding our heart's capacity. Yeah? How about you come in as well? Yeah? Our friends, each other, people who are struggling, people who've been difficult to be with, people who are lovely and delightful and have supported us, all of them welcomed, all of them welcomed. All of them held in the loving gaze. Yeah? All of them cared for, welcomed in. And this quality of metta is said to be a sublime abiding. And there's this line, I think this is the last stanza of the poet, it's like a poem. Yeah, let's call it a poem. It's a metta sutta, but it's kind of like a poem. So this is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is completely liberated. A sublime abiding. Not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, freed from all desires, is fully liberated, free from all greed and all ill will. So there's an interesting line in there, not holding to fixed views. And my friend and wonderful, wonderful teacher, Rob Babea, pointed this out, not holding to fixed views. Just kind of pops in there. You know, what's that mean? I think it means, he thinks it means like the extremes of existence or non-existence. It means to see that everything is empty. not holding to fixed views of existence or non-existence. A very fine space that qualities like metta open out to us, make available to us. Meaning we don't cling to anything, understanding that it neither exists nor does not exist. It's dependently arising. And the less we push and pull, the less appearance and self appear, come into being. And when we intentionally let go of clinging to subtler appearance, the subtler they become. Yeah. This is a divine abiding. This is a sublime abiding, where we truly get into contact with the reality that is empty, that is fabricated. And one of the most beautiful ways of fabricating experience is via metta. And so, in our meditative awareness, may we cultivate the qualities which we see lead to the deepest possible liberation. Let's just share a minute together to close for tonight's session. Letting whatever object in your attention be held in metta. Letting any sense of self practicing here be held in metta. May it radiate out and support all beings everywhere to be held in metta. Sublime abiding. Not holding to fixed views.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.